my lovely assistant.
I get to be lovely.
When I nod, okay. In a meaningful way.
Okay.
All right. I thought I would open this talk by quoting myself. my book of poems, Monuments of a Summer Hat. And this is a poem that I wrote many years ago called The Annunciation. And if you remember, the Annunciation is a famous subject for paintings in the Western world, that moment when the angel comes to Mary and announces that she is going to have a baby, much to her great surprise. And so this is a sort of the theme of kind of initiation as well as annunciation. And that will have more ramifications later. But this is my own interpretation of that story, my own personal annunciation. The Annunciation. I always felt you were real, even in school. When others talked of the dialectics of capital, the sexual struggle, the fragments of each hour moved in my watch with a skeletal whisper, I heard your wingtips dragging the ceiling, the rustle of linen as you bent lower and peered into the face of a local girl drunk on the scent of beeswax. She was not frightened, just empty. She had expected a message, but you were disturbingly literal, holding a lily whose mouth was a star of sorrow. A flutter of Latin rippled in midair above you. It read, when we translated it, beware, my sweet mouth, the beeswax, the rustle of gowns. Of course, it was too late. From the moment you entered, she was yours utterly as I was. The two of us set off immediately without our coats along the way of sorrows. And that's a poet speaking about beauty and about beauty as one of the many religious ways. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about today. And I wanted to pick up from, because Nikki's talk was so exciting, and I actually got so excited thinking about it that I completely left the cart out whenever I came running back at about 1 or 2. Dick had to call security and put it away because I was so engrossed in what she was talking about. Can everyone see here, because I'm going to be giving you a lot of slides, so if you can't see, you might want to scoot over a little bit. So Nikki was pointing out about the strange metamorphosis of Disney princesses and their extreme expansion of their eye size relative to head size, and pointing out how that replicates a baby's facial structure where the eyes are so much larger. And what's interesting about that is, from an evolutionary standpoint, the baby's face is made to lock onto the mother's gaze. And so there's this kind of sense of the female figure being infantilized. But I had an extra gloss on that, which I knew about because my daughter is very much into Japanese manga. And there is in Japanese culture something called the bishonen, which are these young men with these enormous eyes. They're usually drawn with long limbs, silky or flowing hair, and slender eyes with long eyelashes that can sometimes extend beyond the face. The character's sex appeal is highlighted through introducing the character by using an eroticized full-page spread. Bulging muscles are not considered bishonen, as they are too masculine. Their characters are really rather androgynous. If you could give me the next slide. Aha! The bishonen is typically slender with clear skin, stylish hair, and distinctly feminine facial features such as high cheekbones, but simultaneously retains a male body. This androgynous appearance is akin to the depiction of angels in Western Renaissance art. And this, of course, is Justin Bieber. And as you know, he's like the hottest thing in popular culture. And the reason I brought this up partly as a way of picking up the thread from last time, but also as a way of saying that that beauty is such a difficult subject, because on the one hand, I agree with everything that was said last time about the sort of ideological spin, but I also think that it's very odd to consider that young women are looking for these androgynous male figures, and they're even attractive to men. And the question is, what else is going on? You know, what why is this beautiful is more than just a question of how we're being manipulated, but also a question of what is it inside us that's longing for this androgynous male. What a weird thing, right? So I wanted to start talking a little bit about beauty from my own particular perspective, which is one who studied to be an artist. So you're getting the poet's perspective. But I start with, as always, we start with this defining our terms. And one of the problems that we have in English is that our beauty is a rather, it's a term which is both praise and pejorative at the same time. It comes from the Latin bellus, pretty, handsome, charming, and classical Latin used especially of women and children. So we get that idea that to be beautiful is a feminine thing. Ironically or insultingly of men, so a beautiful man, is a bad thing. But it does go back to the Proto-Indo-European base to perform, show, favor, revere. And that's the double edge of it, that on one hand, it can be viewed as a thing, as someone you want to control, who is subservient, who is, infantilized, certainly true. But there's also this sense of show favor and revere. There's a sort of a sense of revering beauty, in which case, on that end of beauty, it becomes something that we actually are almost reduced to a sense of awe about. So how can that be? How can beauty be both things at once? How can it be both below us and above us? And I just threw in the Greek noun for beauty, kalos, beautiful, fine, happy, favorable, has less of a pejorative sense to it, and we'll get into that a little bit. So one of the problems in discussing beauty is that it's so slippery, and it seems to mean everything and nothing at once. And as we all say, well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, so it's completely subjective, right? Or it's completely ideologically driven, or it's socially determined. And yet, also, we all are struck by it. So, traditionally, it's one of the three transcendental roads to knowledge. Or it's one facet of how we know the world. The Greeks thought of truth, goodness, and beauty as this sort of triad. All of them interrelated. But each one has a slightly different framing perspective. Now, in Christian culture, which is very highly influenced by Neoplatonism and its sort of disdain for the physical world, beauty is often very suspect. And I think that colors the way we think about beauty often, is that it is sort of superficial. It's not as important as truth, and certainly not as important as goodness. But is there a way that truth can be beauty and beauty truth? The Greeks believed there were three ingredients to beauty: symmetry, proportion, and harmony, and this triad of principles infused their life. They were attuned to beauty as an object of love and something that was to be imitated and reproduced in their lives, architecture, education, and politics. And they judged life by this mentality. This is also, for them, beauty was the middle way, and we talked, when Ann Plummer was here, talked about the golden mean. But there was this idea that beauty had some kind of relationship to virtue and to truth, because beauty to them represented this idea of harmony and balance, and was allied with the physical world, with the universe and the principles behind the universe. And so it had a powerful reverberation for them. But go to the next. That was sort of sometimes upheld. If you look at that idea of beauty, you'll see it in Christian philosophy. St. Thomas Aquinas affirms the middle way, the golden mean, in his philosophy. But there was a strong sort of contempt of the world, contemptus mundi, in Christian tradition, especially contempt of the female, and contempt of beauty as being worldly, as being part of the damned world, that real beauty could only be in heaven and with God, etc. So the Greeks came to, there's a sort of phenomenon in Western civilization. We have this very strong Christian culture, and simultaneously and side by side, you have a strong classical culture which survives in learning. and in written in the sort of written curriculum. So if you're learning Greek and Latin in your grammar school, then you're, on the one hand, you're being taught a kind of Christian contempt for the aesthetic, and you're actually learning to be kind of anti-aesthetic. And on the other hand, you're reading all this Greek and Roman literature where the beautiful is an important category. It was always a real cognitive dissonance, or another way of looking at it, a very fruitful dialectic or conversation between the classical world and the Christian world. So when we talk about is truth beauty, of course, we're referring to Keats' Ode on a Grecian Urn, which has the which he wrote kind of contemplating Greek antiquities, and this is a sketch that John Keats drew of a Greek vase. And there was a great longing among the poets to sort of return to that ideal of beauty as being important, as being as important as truth and goodness. And of course, the final stanza of his poem, which is an ode to he's looking at this Greek vase, and he's looking at the depictions of a sacrifice, a kind of a village. He's imagining it. It's not actually any Greek vase. He's imagining a Greek vase, but the poem is him contemplating an object from a civilization which revered beauty as a high ideal. And he says of it, "When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, and truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know." Now that's kind of an overstatement. Can't possibly be all you need to know on earth. But you see it as a kind of an attempt to redress this lack of respect for beauty that he sees in his culture. So what is beauty? The quality present in a thing or a person that gives intense pleasure or deep satisfaction to the mind, whether arising from sensory manifestations, a meaningful design or pattern, or something else as personality in which high spiritual qualities are manifest. In that more exact definition, you see actually many definitions. And one of the things I'm putting forth today is that the problem that we have with beauty is that it's extremely complex because it's many, many different things. And I'm going to try and parse those out. That is, beauty refers to many layers. Sensory layer, formal or compositional layer or design layer. There's a biological value, there's social value, and there's psychic value. And because all those things pull different ways, when we say what is beautiful, you may disagree with me about something that's beautiful because you value, let's say, the psychic value over the sensory value or the formal value or the social value or whatever. So someone who's art for art's sake may be really interested in this layer, but not so interested in this layer, right? So the many different demands on beauty create this confusing aspect of it. I have that as a pyramid, which is very Neoplatonic, things rising up to the psychic value being the most important. We could flip that around, which I'll explain a little later, or the best way to think about it is to say beauty is the impact the world has on the imagination or the psychic response to sense data. And it's really a not. That is, all those separate aspects of beauty are in any particular thing that you find beautiful. Beauty really represents a node in which many things are interlaced. And so if you can begin to trace that out, you can begin to understand. One thing, you can begin to understand how complex beauty is. The other thing is you can begin to understand that you should never simply reduce something to one or the other value. Okay. This is a Rothko painting, and Mark Rothko. It's color field painting, it's abstract expressionist, and people who come to this painting in the art gallery and say, "I don't get it. There's no pictures of nothing," right? Well, as Bray will tell you, you're supposed to be reacting to this as sensory and formal value, and not worrying about what it's depicting or... You know, in other words, that's resting right on that level of beauty that is hardwired in us to react to the color red or the color yellow with certain emotional colors, the way we react to certain musical notes with certain kinds of emotion, major versus minor chords, let's say. So there's that level of beauty. And Emerson says, such is the constitution of all things, and such the plastic power of the human eye, that primary forms as the sky, the mountain, the tree, animal, give us delight in and for themselves, a pleasure arising from outline, color, motion, and grouping. So composition within the frame, let's say, has a kind of universal appeal to us. That there's a, again, it's a kind of constitutive, basic to our nature, that we find things appealing, stimulating, beautiful, right? It doesn't have to mean anything on the sort of intellectual level or the social level. It can just, we can just actually just react to it. Okay. Now we get to the biological level. And it's interesting, if you Google the most beautiful man in the world, which I did, I had a lot of fun on this project. All of them look like they're either faces or they're torsos. And that's clearly evolutionary, right? What we value in the man is the secondary sex characteristics, his ability to defeat the predators and carry heavy rocks or fetch you something. He is healthy. And what I'm trying to say is that those aspects of color and symmetry and all those other things and composition help us to judge who is the most effective mating partner, right? That we can, you can see an evolutionary kind of drive. And Nikki was talking about the golden mean and its relationship to fertility in women, you know, certain... well, let's look at women. You know, you look at this, this is obviously a childbearing mammal, right? And for all the hullabaloo over this, I like to say to my students, you realize, of course, that men are interested in women's breasts because they were babies once. And it blows their minds to think that that's what it's all about, right? Like, oh, that's why I want to stare at them, you know. And similarly, the kind of work that's been done on the beauty of the face, the human face, has to do a lot with the proportions. Angelina Jolie, usually the most beautiful woman in the world, you know, well, there are some very formal reasons for that. As well as other reasons that we discussed, you know, why are her lips bigger than women in previous generations? There are a lot of different ways of looking at this, but basically, on the biological level, we look at people and like them for the same reason we want to eat these fruits. We know they're healthy. We know they're good for us, right? Through long experience, there's this kind of ability of the human brain to judge things based on their aesthetic properties. Okay. And then we get to the social layer. On top of the very sort of primal biological drive, then you know, like 16th century Spain, you know, this is beautiful. It's not very biological, because it's going to be hard for her to bear children with that whalebone corset crunching her innards into nothing, right? But on this level, those techniques, those propensities, composition, form, you know, sense, all those other layers combine with the idea of social prestige. This man is beautiful because he's powerful and because he's showing how much wealth he has. And he's manipulating you with his, you know, self-presentation, using all the senses. These things are beautiful, right? To influence you in a purely social way. We would think this was weird now. If, you know, the social layer changes very quickly, unlike the evolutionary layer. This is a macaroni. Yes, it's 18th century dandy. We wouldn't think that was very handsome now. But you can see the interplay of the social layer. In the Renaissance, the recovery of the idea of the human body and of the dignity of man results in the David. In the medieval period, contempt for the body and for earthly life, you know, it doesn't matter if his head's in his hands. That's St. Denis, you know, and he's heading for heaven where it'll all be okay. His body is completely cloaked. His body is completely naked. You can look nowadays, you know, like, what do we think? You know, like the built body is not a sign of the dignity of man and of the recovery of the Renaissance. It's a sign that you are wealthy enough to join a gym and work out, and you're shamed. If you don't move, you get fat. You're being shamed, right, for social reasons again. And this could never be beautiful in 20th century America, despite the fact that that's what we all look like. However, you might be beautiful in Japan, where the social layer includes a deep reverence for the sumo wrestler and his great weight. All right, so now we come to the next layer, which would be the psychic layer, which would be, having said all this and having talked about how socially powerful and how we're all being influenced by these tendencies for the aesthetic to be captured by the hegemonic institutions of power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, this does not explain why love feels the way it does. I mean, we can talk forever about why certain people are more attractive to us because we expect certain things in terms of grooming and facial characteristics. There's a certain evolutionary expectation that they have, bilateral symmetry, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, that's not how love feels, is it? It doesn't feel like you're just trying to find the perfect baby factory or sperm donor, nor does it feel like you're just trying to get married so that you can make money or have a secure home, even though those things are true. They are all involved in the knot. If you Google soulmate, you will find a lot of interesting things on the web, including these parrots, which seem to appear with a frightening regularity. But define the exact name of your love soulmate now. What do we mean when we say soulmate? What do we mean when we say soul, and how does that get dragged into love? That actually comes from Plato's Symposium, where Aristophanes, the playwright, told the story of how at one point we were actually round beings consisting of two human beings wedded together into this weird creature. We were very powerful, and we kept trying to climb up into Olympus, so Zeus got mad and split us in half, and ever since we've been looking for our other half. That longing for completion, you feel that, right? That's a psychic layer. And a modern interpretation would be, in traditional Jungian thought, the psyche of men and women is conceived of as a relationship between the conscious and the unconscious mind. Jung posits the unconsciousness of each man and woman is personified by symbols or figures of the opposite sex. A man's unconscious is personified by female figures, while a woman's unconscious is personified by male figures. Individuation is accomplished through a conscious encounter with the unconscious, which is symbolized by contrasexual symbols. The male achieves individuation by confronting his unconscious, personified as a feminine anima, and likewise the woman does the same with a male animus. And this is a way of understanding love as not as just sexual attraction, but as actually a route to knowledge and as a spiritual journey, right? So even though all those other things are there, the social, the biological, the merely sensual and formal, or I shouldn't even say merely, but the sensual and formal, within that also is a psychic need that we have to complete ourselves, to integrate the masculine and feminine halves, which are really the imagos of our parents deep within us. You know, we have our masculine and feminine characteristics. Now, the Jungian is very, very heterosexual, and I would say that the original story from the symposium was saying that, you could even be two men welded together and split in half, or two women. And in fact, in the symposium, the homosexual love is considered better because it's more selfless. It's not attached to simply the biological urge to reproduce. When a man loves the beautiful, what does he desire? Says Socrates, who weighs in on this. So Diotima, he has to go to a woman, by the way, to find out what love means. Diotima. And she says, what is given by the possession of beauty? To what you have asked, I replied, I have no answer. And she says, let me put the word good in the place of the beautiful and repeat the question once more. If he who loves the good, he who loves good, what is then that he loves? The possession of the good. What does he gain who possesses the good? Happiness, I replied. And this is the reason why when the hour of conception arrives, the teeming nature is full. And the teeming nature is full. There's such a flutter and ecstasy about the beauty whose approach is the alleviation of the pain of travail. For love is not as you imagine, Socrates, the love of the beautiful only. What then? The love of generation and of birth and beauty. Why of generation? Because to the mortal creature, generation is a sort of eternity and immortality, and if it has been already admitted, love is of the everlasting possession of the good, all men will desire immortality together with the good. Wherefore, love is of immortality. Now, there's a lot to unpack there. I don't really have time to go into it, but I would point out that love, that sexual love in many traditions, including the Bhakti tradition of India, St. Teresa of Avila, the Islamic tradition of Rumi, the beloved is a longing towards God, towards immortality. That feeling that is awakened by the sensual becomes, Freud would say, I suppose, sublimated, but he's a bit of a reductionist, into something much more powerful. And this is the so-called Platonic ladder. The true order of going, of being led by another to the things of love, is to begin from the beauties of the earth and mount upwards for the sake of that other beauty, using these as steps only, and from one going on to two, and from two to all fair forms, and from fair forms to fair practices, and from fair practices to fair notions, until from fair notions he arrives at the notion of absolute beauty, and alas knows what the essence of beauty is. Now, that's Platonism. That's a bit extreme, perhaps, for us, but I think I will adhere to this notion that as we go through life, we learn greater and greater depth because of the aesthetic allure of things and our wish to understand them. We begin to understand there is a greater component of beauty, which the 19th century called moral beauty. This is the Wolf on the Plains of Abraham, a famous painting depicting an act of bravery, which they considered beautiful. And if you think the Greeks also believed this, they believed that the reason that they would have no trouble with don't ask, don't tell in the army is because they believed that you should have homosexuals only in the army because they loved each other so much, they would perform great deeds of bravery to impress each other. So the idea of an all-gay army was very important to them. Or as Emerson says, beauty is the mark God sets upon virtue. Every natural action is graceful, every heroic act is decent and causes the place and the bystanders to shine. We may think that's weird because we don't believe that war is good. But what about Lincoln? Is this face beautiful to us? Is his virtue beautiful? Is this face beautiful to us, even though it lacks all of the important components of beauty? Is this face beautiful to us? This is William Stafford. This face is very beautiful to me because I love this man. Fur is beautiful. The fur of animals is beautiful. Why do we suddenly turn anti-aesthetic? Why do we turn against it? Because we've decided that it's not virtuous. The iPod is beautiful. However, if you're like me and you think about the minerals mined in dangerous areas where people are being exploited in the factories, we recently found out where they are made are not good. We can no longer see the iPod maybe as beautiful as we thought. And finally, just really quickly, there is what they call intellectual beauty. Pythagoras was the first to say there is a kind of mathematical center to beauty. We talked about the golden mean before. If you Google what's the most beautiful equation in the world, you find a lot of people have them tattooed. This is Euler's equation. This is the speed of light or something. There are people who find mathematics so beautiful. I was hoping Steve would. Oh, Steve is here. Is mathematics beautiful?
The short answer is yes.
There you go. We now know a lot of the math behind some of the beauty and variety of nature. And there's a sense in which that intellectual beauty is our ability to perceive, again, our union, our oneness with the entire fabric of nature, which is a very sublime experience. The standard of beauty, says Emerson, is the entire circuit of natural forms, the totality of nature, which the Italians express by defining beauty. Nothing is quite beautiful alone. Il più nell'uno. Nothing is beautiful, but is beautiful in the whole. And this is the Crab Nebula, which is extraordinarily beautiful. Okay, one more. All right, so I was going to say a little bit about art, but I think you get the gist that if you follow beauty as this inextricable knot of many different things, it helps to think about how it might become a spiritual power for us. Because although it is true that the beautiful is not always true or not always good, it is true that sometimes it very much is. And I think what you have to do is you're always weighing which level of beauty are you talking about and sort of sorting. You know, if you find something beautiful, is it also the beauty of virtue? Is it the beauty, you know, of, is it psychic beauty? If we find something shallow, it's often because we feel that those other parts of the knot are not being laced into it. And I will say as a closing comment that one of the powerful things about Unitarianism was that they early on accepted that the artist and art and poetry, the arts in general, were sacred ways of knowing the world. And they did not discriminate between secular and sacred art. Because they were Unitarians, everything was united, everything was one. So they early began reading poetry not just from the Bible, but from Wordsworth, who was very important to them, or from Keats and other romantic poets. And then they expanded out, and Emerson was a famous translator of Hafez and Sa'di and other Islamic poets, for example, and as well as the Chinese and Japanese literature. And so this idea that beauty is universal and its expression is universal in art is a very Unitarian principle. And with that, I think I'll stop because I've run out of time. Thank you. I guess we'll talk at coffee.
It took me.